Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is your Future State Friday for the third week of Future State titles. And I'm joined by a couple of my fellow comic book pundits. We have Comic Boom and Dark Knight Nation. Nick, unfortunately, is under the weather. He does not have COVID. He had that earlier in the year, but he just has a really bad sore throat. I talked to him earlier. He sounds like he sounds sick. So he tried to make a go of it, but couldn't. So he should be back next week. But anyway, we were talking before we recorded about the good and the bad. I think Boom and I both are of the opinion that this is the best week of Future State yet, which I know it's a low bar, but you know, at least things are positive. But that's not to say that there aren't problems. And I'm sure we'll get to those. So, you know, where do you guys want to start? Anybody have any, you want to start with the positive? Do we want to start with the book we think is the worst? What do we?
Just based on the string of kind of negativity we've had, I feel like we should end on the good stuff.
Okay. All right. Well, then let's start with Shazam. let me get to the credits here. So it's written by Tim Sheridan.
Oh, Tim.
We have pencils by Eduardo Pansica, inks are by Julio Ferreira, colors by Marcelo Maiello, and letters by Rob Lee. So, you know, like I said, I think this week overall is a pretty good week. And it wasn't even that I didn't enjoy this book, but it was really predictable. You know, I knew like right from the beginning, and even predictable to the point where, you know, you see Billy wakes up, or I should say, you see Shazam, and he's constantly telling people, don't call me Billy. But you see Shazam in the first couple of pages wake up. He's wearing some sort of crystal around his neck. And then later in the book, they're talking about all these murders, and it looks like people have been stabbed by this crystal. And you're like, I mean, right there, you're like, okay, I already suspected that this was either some villain that got the Shazam power, or, you know, some other kind of thing. But it was so clear that Shazam was this double agent, was this bad guy, and was, you know, behind these murders. And, you know, once they talk about that crystal, then it, you know, for lack of a better term, or excuse my pun, it all crystallizes, comes into focus, and it's so clear that it's him. But on the other hand, I'm like, here is the Justice League. And granted, they're not necessarily considered detectives, you know, they're more heroes. But you have Renee Montoya version of Question there, right? You have Miss Martian. She's supposed to be pretty smart. Like, you have these people that should be able to figure this out. I mean, they are questioning Shazam. This has to have been going on for a long period of time. And so when they finally have concrete proof, you know, they slow down some video of some corrupted data that came from a drone camera. And they're like, oh, yeah, here we saw you kill the creeper. I'm like, there was no suspicion before this that you couldn't have done this sooner. Like, I don't know. It just seemed kind of lazy to me. And then the other part that didn't make sense to me is, so, you know, at the end, we see that the version of Captain Marvel or Shazam that we know, where it's, you know, Billy and Captain Marvel together as heroes that are, you know, in hell years ago. And in order to stop these catastrophic things from happening, they had to use somebody who's full of innocence. So they Neron separated Captain Marvel and Billy, and Billy's just left like hanging in place as a literal door. He's just chained up to block this other door to keep the minions of hell from escaping or something. It didn't even make a lot of sense to me why that needed to be the thing, but really he's just going to spend eternity just like tied to a door. That's kind of weird. But even if that's the case, so why is it that if you separate the Captain Marvel persona from Billy Batson, why does the Captain Marvel persona turn into a serial killer? Like, that wasn't explained at all either. As far as the art goes, I thought it was fine. It wasn't anything special. I didn't see anything glaring that, you know, pulled me out of the story. But I don't know. I kind of felt, even though I could see where it was going, I thought, okay, well, this has potential. This has potential. But then the problems I had with it sort of started stacking up. And I should also say that I'm a big Creeper fan. So when he showed up, I was like, oh, cool, we're going to get some Creeper in Future State. And then they just kill him. So I'm like, all right, I'll come up with that. That didn't last long. So, I didn't hate it, but I didn't love it. Again, I think the overall quality of it, it's pretty average. You know, some things that don't make sense, and whether you want to blame it on editorial or you want to blame it on, you know, Tim Sheridan himself, maybe it's the difference between writing for animation versus writing for comics. I don't know, but yeah, it wasn't terrible. I didn't hate it. It certainly was better than his Teen Titans title. So I can say that about it. Yeah, it was okay.
Was it? Was it really?
I thought it was okay.
I mean, I thought it was ass, to be quite frank. Also, just a quick clarification. This question isn't even Renee Montoya.
Oh, I thought Renee, it was.
No, so there's a literal line of dialogue where Shazam goes, "When are you going to tell us who you really are?" Question. Sage went to Arkham. You're not Montoya. And Drake, I killed him myself.
Right. Yeah.
So we don't even know who that question is. I mean, you know, it's not of my primary concern, but yeah, I mean, like, let's talk about this Shazam book. First of all, the trope of Shazam being inhuman when he loses his human host, I'm over it. We've done this a million times before, and it's been done by better writers. So I don't need Tim Sheridan to do it, frankly. And consistent with what he was doing in Teen Titans, his dialogue is always really, really quick to shift subject between characters, or even a character continuing their own dialogue. It comes off as super disorienting. Half the time you don't really know what they're getting at. And something that I'm having a hard time understanding here is that they established the fact that this Justice League is recognized internationally, and yet, like, Gotham is in a total state of disrepair and has, like, all of this anti-mask law enforcement, but, like, federally we're okay with the masks. Like, that's totally fine. So it goes from being, like, for all intents and purposes, condoned by the federal government, but it is criminalized by Gotham's local government. That doesn't make a lot of sense.
That totally makes sense. There's stuff like that in real life.
But
like marijuana, for example, illegal federally, states are legalizing it.
But it's not criminalized, though, in the United States anymore. It's criminal. Like, wearing a mask in Gotham is criminalized in Gotham.
Sure.
Yeah.
Local law.
Well, every state has their own criminal code in the U.S., but I'll admit that for overall, there that might lend to some reader confusion if you're reading all of Future State. But so I understand the point you're making, but I don't. I mean, I would agree with Chase that I understood the distinction, but I also concede that I think as an overall part of the narrative, there's some inconsistency there that might throw some people off.
Right. And like, regarding that context in general, he's like underexposing the context that we need while trying to smash it together with like his already really disjointed Teen Titans narrative. Obviously, there's a little point to what's happening in Green Lantern and a point to what's happening with the Suicide Squad. Tim Sheridan, just consistently from what I've read for him out of Future State, has a hard time keeping himself grounded on any singular ideas. Everything is always going all over the place, and it ends up feeling really directionless and, like, frankly, kind of convoluted. And I know we were talking about Billy Batson, an adolescent being left to defend the gates of hell. First of all, how does one with the wisdom of Solomon literally make a deal with the devil? Like, in earnest, like, without even questioning himself. Second of all, why are we leaving an adolescent boy to guard the gates of hell, nonetheless chained up? What's he going to do? There's a million superheroes to guard Earth or the realm of the living. Why does Shazam need to be out there and not Billy Batson? I feel like Billy Batson could probably do more good, clearly, than Shazam is out there. But I don't know. It doesn't make a lot of sense. Just overall, Sheridan seems like he has a million ideas and crams them all into one hyper unreadable narrative. And I echo Jace's sentiments on art. You know, it's not horrible. Definitely not anywhere near the worst of what we've seen from Future State. Definitely not anywhere near some of the worst art we've seen this week. Also not memorable. So, you know, it's still above like the typical threshold of Future State. So I'll give the art that much credit.
Well, I'm gonna be a little bit more kind than you were, Trevor, on this. I actually think that I'm gonna give the compliment I would give to Tim Sheridan the same compliment on Teen Titans is that he's got some really good ideas. He's got some really good ideas, but of course it just falls apart on execution and pacing and structure. One of the things that I really liked, I've not read as the Shazam books that you've read, Trevor, but I think one of the most unexplored aspects of Shazam is the relationship between Shazam and Billy Batson. When they are separated, I'm not familiar. I haven't read a lot of Shazam in the past, other than maybe from Geoff Johns, his run. But I think it's very interesting what happens when you separate Shazam from Billy Batson. Billy Batson is pure. And so I find it very interesting that the purity of Billy Batson's soul somehow, he was chosen. Billy Batson is special. He was chosen by the wizard because of the purity of his heart. Apparently that somehow gives him some credence to protect the Rock of Eternity from Neuron's influence. That's interesting, but it's unexplored. Even the title of this story, The Last Temptation of William Batson, I found very interesting. Is that a clue to the narrative? The Last Temptation of William Batson. Well, we have to understand that he's older. I find the title is somewhat odd, and I couldn't really link. What does that title have to do with the narrative itself? With respect to the art, I thought the art was excellent. I thought it was really good. There are some scenes here. There's one with the creeper in particular, looked fantastic. There was two scenes when he's waking up from his dream. He's waking up on the bed. One, he's just wearing shorts, and the other one, he's wearing his Shazam costume, and clearly he's going through some kind of hell. He's possessed. I don't know what's possessing Shazam, but clearly he's going through something. We know that Billy Batson whispered something in his ear. And just to pick up on a point you made, Trevor, about the wisdom of Solomon. I mean, we're looking for some evidence of the wisdom. Where is it in this narrative? Clearly, Billy Batson, when he whispered something to Shazam, there's a plan that Billy Batson had, and we're not privy to it. And this is one thing where Tim Sheridan falls short. And we're going to be talking about Nightwing later, and I don't want to talk too much about Nightwing, but I will say this, that one of the significant differences between this and what the writer on Nightwing does, whose name bloody well,
Andrew Constant.
Thank you, Andrew Constant. Andrew Constant, so much better, is that throughout all the action in Nightwing, you're getting the blanks filled in. You understand what's going on. You're getting the history as well as a fantastic pacing and tone and everything else. We're not getting that here. We're just getting more questions after question after questions, and usually from the character, the question, and we don't even know who the question is. And it's just overall, again, I'm actually interested in this Shazam story, because I find Shazam, Billy Batson dichotomy interesting, but Tim Sheridan just doesn't quite know how to drive the point home.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, the again, between the title and then with Billy telling Shazam, I need you to make sure I can't for any reason abandon my post. Like, I don't know. It almost seems like maybe did Neron, before Shazam left hell, did Neron could take him over? I mean, that would explain why. But then at the same time, it's like, I'm going to protect the world the way I see fit. You know, right. He is only killing, you know, supposed bad guys. So I don't know. A lot of questions to be answered, like Boom said, and you know, only one issue left to do it. So I guess we'll see how that works out. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's move on. Let's talk about Superman Worlds of War. A lot of creators, there's four different stories in here. So Philip Kennedy Johnson is the writer on the first main story, I guess you'd say, or the only main story. Mikel Yanin, artist, Jordi Belair on colors, Dave Sharp on letters. And then there's a second story with that same creative team that did the same Mr. Miracle, Shiloh Norman version of Mr. Miracle in Superman of Metropolis. So it's Brandon Easton, which is the same writer. It's the same artist. Valentin DeLandro on art, Marissa Louise on colors, and Dave Sharp on letters. We follow up that with a Midnighter story from Becky Cloonan and Michael W. Conrad, who are the same writers that are going to be doing Wonder Woman, the Immortal Wonder Woman. And Gleb Melnikov is the artist, with Jordi Belair on colors and Travis Lanham on letters. And then we have a new Black Racer, a female version of the Black Racer, if you're not familiar, from Jack Kirby's Fourth World, sort of a harbinger of death, as he's been a character in the past. As I said, there's a new version of the Black Racer, a female version. It's written by Jeremy Adams. The art is by Sia colors by Hi-Fi, and letters by Gabrielle Downey. So yeah, I wanted to like this more than I did, especially because it's Mikel Yanin art, but it doesn't bode well for me with Philip Kennedy Johnson on the regular Superman title, because I mean, to me, this is where you're going to make your hay, right? Like, it's Superman, and I know Batman pays the bills, but we have talked a lot on this podcast about how, as goes Superman, so goes the state of the DC universe. Like, you know, your Batman titles are going to sell, but if your Superman titles are doing well, if they're being well received, then that's sort of indicative of the whole line being well received and them selling well and people liking the state of the DC universe. So we get this story, The Many Lives of Clark Kent, and it's obviously set in the future, as all the future state stories are, and Superman is missing, and everybody obviously knows it's Clark Kent. So we have this story of this girl going to Smallville, and it's filled with hucksters and this sort of fair. It's the anniversary of the meteor shower that supposedly when Superman crashed to Earth, and a bunch of people get together who have been saved by Superman in the past. And it's, you know, they're comparing stories and talking about what Superman means to them. And they have, you know, various ideas. And some of them are saying, you know, Superman is the best of us. And they're talking about him sort of in memoriam, making this assumption that maybe he's dead or maybe he transcended. There's all these different theories. And this one girl that we're following is like, he's not gone. He's Superman. You know, you guys are totally missing the point. My point is that we get sort of 15 pages of these disparate ideas of who Superman is. And then I guess the girl's point of view is who Philip Kennedy Johnson sees Superman as, I guess. Like, it's not 100% clear. Does he see him as this kind of, you know, ray of hope or, you know, whatever? I don't really have a firm grasp on it. The thing I think about the story mostly is this kind of thing has been done before with Superman, like a bunch of just regular people get together and talk about who Superman is to them. And generally they come to a consensus. Here, there is no consensus. So again, this just feels very derivative and very repetitive. And it's been done before many times. And almost every time it's been done before, it's been done better. This just isn't very well written to me. It's really choppy. Mm. And also I don't usually pick up a Superman book to get only two pages of Superman. That's the biggest problem I had with it. You know, once we're done with this, we see Superman on some new version of the war world, you know, Mongol. And we like, he's literally on like two pages. And one of the pages you barely can see that it's him.
He's at four pages. He's on four pages, and there the other 18 pages. I've just counted them. 18 pages dealing with the girl, and the people are on the campfire talking about Superman, and four pages of Superman. That's it.
I guess the one's a double page spread. Yeah. So yeah, you're
I mean,
right.
It's just crazy, but 18, four.
Yeah. And when we see him there, we get nothing in terms of story, literally nothing. And again, there's only one more issue of this. So what the hell am I reading this for? Superman's my favorite character. You want to put him on War World? Okay. I'm not a big fan of the costume, this whole chain kind of thing. And yeah, it just doesn't do it for me. To me, this isn't really Superman, but okay. You know, I'll try to keep an open mind. Maybe it'll be better than I'm expecting. But, you know, let me keep an open mind and see where it goes. And I get like no story with Superman, none whatsoever. And he's barely in it. Like, what the hell am I reading this for? And then you talk about the backup stories. You know, I wasn't a big fan of the Mr. Miracle story in the Superman of Metropolis. I thought this was a lot better. But, you know, the art is still terrible. You know, it's that same artist. And again, we have more questions than answers. The Midnighter story was interesting for the twist right at the end. Everybody knows the history of Midnighter and what's the other guy's name? I always forget.
Apollo.
Apollo, yeah, the sun god or whatever. And they're lovers, and I think they were married at one point. And here at the end, we find out that this organization that Midnighter has been recruited to fight against to help stop War World or rescue Superman or whatever his mission, it's not completely clear, is being led by Apollo. So that little twist at the end's interesting. But I'm not a big enough fan of these characters. I'm not buying a Superman book because I want to read about Midnighter and Apollo. And then the last story with the Black Racer, I thought the art was okay. I've seen Sia do much better art than this. But again, I don't know who the Black Racer is. I'm not a huge Fourth World fan. Would I buy a Black Racer book? Probably not. And now I've got even less interest in it because it's this brand new female version of the Black Racer. So, you know, it wasn't bad for what it was. But again, I'm not buying a Superman book because I want to read about the Black Racer or some version of Mr. Miracle who's not even scot-free, who is the version I prefer. Midnighter and Apollo thrown in here. And bear in mind, like in the Mr. Miracle story, Mr. Miracle's on like every page. In the Midnighter story, he's on like every page. In the Black Racer story, she's on every page. In the Superman story, he's barely there. So overall, it's probably my least favorite book of the week. Oof. Just didn't like it. Felt like a waste of time. The best thing about the book is the Mikkel Yanin art in the first story. But, you know, it's Mikkel Yanin. I expect his art to be fantastic. But, you know, a lot of the other artists that I expect great things from did have a little letdown in quality overall in their Future State book. At least that wasn't the case with Mikkel Yanin. But, yeah, really disappointed in this book. And it has me really worried for Philip Kennedy Johnson's regular Superman work when Infinite Frontier starts. So what'd you think, Boom?
Well, I will say that in fairness, if somebody is just coming on to the Superman Future State books, those 18 pages, if you're not familiar with what's gone on in the past, it is inspirational. It talks about what people think of Superman. It's beautifully drawn. I just think it misses an opportunity. It had 18 pages to explain and fill in the blanks as to what's happened in the past. That those 18 pages could have been used to elucidate the timelines that Future State involves. It could have explained things through people thinking about Superman, and it did it in parts. We got some hints as to what may be coming in the future yet, and there's some hints as to what happened in the past. But if you're having people wondering where Superman is, how could they talk for 18 pages and we don't really know what the hell happened in Metropolis, or we don't really know how we got there? It just seemed like wasted dialogue and a bunch of platitudes. It reminds me when I always bitch about reading a Wonder Woman comic half the time, when she's preaching all the time, a bunch of platitudes over seven pages signifying nothing and no movement of the plot. That's what this felt like. Again, beautifully drawn. And I love Mikkel Yanin's art, but at the end of the day, when it's drawing a story that has no substance. And now the most interesting part of this issue of Superman War of the Worlds is, We with Mr. Miracle, the Black Racer, and the Midnighter story, we actually get some substance. We can finally fill in the blanks a little bit. For example, we know that Mr. Miracle takes place right after Superman of Metropolis, world, whatever that was, Man of Metropolis, and he's clearly, he finds himself on War World, surrounded by a bunch of dead people and dead metahumans. So clearly one can infer, I'm inferring all this, that Mongol is clearly transporting through the use of his sentinels, the same sentinel that transferred, that hit Mr. Miracle, transferred him to War World. I think clearly they're collecting various specimens and warriors for War World all over the multiverse or the universe, I'm guessing. And then Mr. Miracle runs into Midnighter of all people. Midnighter is there on his mission to try to obtain this neridium, which can apparently has the power to end all human suffering, according to Apollo. And so there's that agenda going on. And I don't know who Midnighter's working for. It might be Apollo. I'm not sure if Apollo's on his side or not. I thought that was a little unclear, but clearly there's some intricate plot threads going on here. Black Racer, she's involved. She's part of the entertainment. It's like she's like gladiatorial combat on Warworld to entertain the masses on Warworld. All of Warworld is structured to bring people there to fight for the entertainment of the masses. And meanwhile, you've got all these little subplots going on that are affecting Earth. And I got more questions than answers. Again, there's probably a better story here that needs to be told differently, but overall, you can see the seeds, by the way. Just a quick note. Remember about 6 months ago, we got that rumor that Bendis was going to be writing, or somebody was going to be writing, as Superman leads the Authority. You can kind of see that here. Like, maybe at some point, was Superman going to lead the Authority because Midnighter and Apollo would rescue him on Warworld and he'd come back to Earth and lead the Authority? You can kind of see how they mishmashed and how all those plans fell apart. And now they want to try to put lipstick on the pig of Future State. And they're throwing all this together in a couple of issues and all these titles and with a different effect. Quick comment on Black Racer. I don't know. Did you guys get the feel of Alita Battle Angel? When I looked at Black Racer, I thought of that movie Alita the Battle Angel. That's what I thought of. I thought this was a ripoff of Alita Battle Angel. I wasn't really familiar with Black Racer of the Fourth World. So I thought that was kind of interesting there.
No, but the vibe that I got was, oh, Naomi did really well. Let's create a new version of Black Racer and cross her with Naomi. Because Naomi did well, and so maybe we can, you know, catch lightning in a bottle again.
Yeah, well, fair enough. But in any event, overall, I think this would be a very expensive comic book to pick up. Certainly, I think it's very unfair to the masses. I couldn't recommend people pick this up because it's a Superman comic, War of the Worlds. And let me might I just criticize one thing again? It's called Superman War of the Worlds, and the actual title of the 22-page Superman story in it is actually The Many Lives of Clark Kent.
Yep.
I mean, what the hell is that? I mean, it's actually called The Many Lives of Clark Kent, and then the next one is going to be called The Many Deaths of Superman. It just seems to me to be, there's definitely a disconnect between the marketing and the story. And again, I'm probably being a little bit harsh on it because read as a whole, I can put together some of the narrative threads. As I was telling you, Chase, earlier, rereading some of these issues two or three times because we do this podcast, I'm starting to pick up where maybe some of those connections lie, but it's challenging and it shouldn't be that challenging. I don't.
Yeah. I mean, if you ask me, because nobody did, so I'm just going to say it anyways. I think that these stories should be able to read on their own, like as a central point. Maybe there are small little nuggets that you can sort of take and pull and combine and enhance the overall experience. But if there are sort of crucial elements contained within or that are disparately spread across multiple stories, it's immediately a failure of the work as a whole. I guess just starting from the front. Yeah, I was really disappointed with Philip Kennedy Johnson. I've actually been championing his announcement and his sort of appointment to the Superman titles. And his story read like an anthology story that's already been done. That was also 14 pages too long. Nothing happened. There's no plot here whatsoever, which I'm not totally against, right? When you have two issues in a series and there's no plot in issue one, how are you now going to complete a 3 or 5 act structure of plot in one issue? Spoilers, kids, you don't. So what happens here is that Philip Kennedy Johnson, like Jace so aptly mentioned, has this sort of essay, right, on who Superman is to the people, what he represents in this, and in many ways is taken out of the context that it should have been in. It's been done before. We've seen it. We've seen it done more tightly. And it felt like Philip Kennedy Johnson going, see, I get Superman. I get what he means to people. See, I put it on page. Mikkel Janin drew it, and it looks really good. Looks really good. By the way, I think this is some of Mikkel Janin's best art in a while, which is ironic. I thought he was super tight, but you get so far into the story, and then, like you mentioned, sure, technically four pages of Superman. In reality, it's more like two, and one of them's a splash image. Yeah. How much are we getting done? And don't get me wrong. I love stuff like what happened to the Caped Crusader, where you get the sort of perspective of the title character, or you get an understanding of the title character from multiple different perspectives. And it can be this very beautiful and sort of poetic analysis of the many sort of bits of symbolism that icon can represent. But again, here, we've seen it. It's been done before, and it went on for way too long. The pacing was absolutely horrendous for this story. And it does worry me as to what Johnson is going to be doing when he's given more time to stretch things out. Imagine that. You're given two issues. Arguably, your scripting should be as tight as humanly possible, and there's no plot in issue one. So what are you going to do when you have 12 issues? 20 issues? Who knows? But again, let's give credit where credit's due. Mikkel Janin knocked what he had out of the park. I mean, what he's doing with camera, what he's doing with beat-to-beat story paneling, brilliantly done. Visual narrative is great. We get a host of practically splash images of Superman being Superman, and it looks great. It's just too bad the script couldn't back any of it up. Moving on into the alternative stories. God, this Mr. Miracle art looks like my 3-year-old nephew did it, to be quite frank with you. I actually think I've seen better work from him. It's just, I can't get past how bad this art is. Like, I couldn't even pay attention to the narrative of the story based on how lackluster the visual art was. So there's that. The Midnighter story, rather pedestrian, felt like a 90s Image comic. Art definitely felt like a 90s Image comic. Kind of loose. I actually thought that the end was rather predictable. I was like, what twist? What's the only twist you could possibly have at the end of this book? Either Apollo's the enemy or Apollo's the guy behind the curtain that's on his side. There's like, when there's Midnighter, there is Apollo. And I don't even read a lot of Midnighter, and I know that. So I can only imagine how painstakingly obvious it might have been for somebody that does. And frankly, the Black Racer story, I was so done with this book by the end of the Midnighter story, I didn't even realize there was a Black Racer story. So there's that. Good job, DC. You did great.
Yeah, I totally agree with you on the fact that if you need to read, because like Boom said, yeah, if you read all the stories, you can pull other things and kind of get some context where Superman is. But to Trevor's point, like, yeah, you shouldn't have to. They should be able to stand alone on their own if they're separate stories. Otherwise, you would have been better off just telling one big story.
Right.
Just tie them all together, and then you don't have to worry about as many transitions. And you maybe could have got even, we would know even more of what's going on. And you could have done the whole, people on Earth in Smallville talking about what Superman means to them. You could have done those as little interludes here and there to transition from story to story. That might have worked out better,
I was going to say, imagine by the grace of the comic book gods, if we could have just gotten all of that drawn by Mikkel Janin instead of this smattering of mediocrity after Mikkel Janin. I mean, Jesus, I mean, for all of you hip hop fans out there, it felt like Kendrick Lamar's last album. Let's lead the album with the best song by far and then just let the rest of it go. And I mean, at least that was a good album. So let's not put down Kendrick Lamar. But this was like you lead with your A guy artistically, and it just plummets from there, frankly.
Yeah, it was tough. It was tough. All right, well, let's move on. Let's talk about the next Batman number two. There's three stories in here. So we have the main story by John Ridley, Nick Darrington, who did the art for the next Batman chapter one. He just does the breakdowns here, and they're finished by Laura Braga. colors are by Arif Prianto and letters are by Clayton Cowles. Then we get a Batgirl story that's written by Vita Ayala. The art in that one is by, I think it was Aneki, whose art I'm not familiar with. They go by one name. Yeah, just Aneki. Colors there by Trish Mulvihill and letters by Becca Carey. And then we had a Gotham City Sirens story that starred Catwoman, Poison Ivy, and some sort of, was she like a
domestic droid called Dee Dee.
Domestic droid, that's what it was. For some reason, I was thinking she was like a some kind of a sex bot, but I think I was getting that confused with.
Well, that's what I thought of her as.
Yeah. I read Scumbag 4 that came out this last week, and that had a sex robot in it. So I must have been confusing the two. But anyway, this one's by Paula Sevenbergen. Never heard of that writer before. That's definitely a last name that will stick with you. Breakdown by Swedish. Rob Haynes, Emmanuel Lupacchino on pencils, Wade Von Grobiger on inks. So yeah, it was okay. I thought the art in the next Batman story was, it's recognizable as Laura Braga. Interesting that she's going over Nick Darrington, because I don't really see much of Darrington in here at all. But it didn't grab me, and I thought the best parts of the story actually didn't have anything to do with Batman. But there's a couple of interesting ideas that Ridley's going with. And they, we've talked about, okay, what's the point of Future State? Boom especially has made this point several times about doing these flash forwards that end up not going anywhere and not mattering, kind of like Future's End. But I know, based on kind of the way this came to be with it being 5G before, and we've talked about it at length of how, AT&T doesn't want to waste the work they've already paid for. You are going to see the magistrate and the rise of the magistrate, or at least them try to gain power in Gotham. You're going to see some of that. You're going to see, like, for example, the Tim Sheridan Teen Titans. We're going to see that Titans Academy. So, once we start Infinite Frontier, you are going to see some seeds being planted that could eventually lead to these futures. Now, the thing about the next Batman part two here, where we see the mayor, Nakano, who's a character right now in Detective and was in the Peter J. Tomasi run. And I assume because he won the election to become mayor, is going to show up in Mariko Tamaki's run as well. And, she's writing Dark Detective also. But here's the thing, like, you are, based on his behavior here and what he's espousing, like, I was sort of neutral on him before. I was like, well, he seems kind of misguided with what he's doing in Detective Comics in present day, but you can kind of see where he's coming from. Based on the way he's acting here, now all of a sudden I can't do anything but despise the guy. So you have totally pigeonholed him as a character going forward in Detective, if anybody's read this. Now, whether or not he can be redeemed and if Tamaki can take him in a different direction, because again, it's just one possible future, that's to be determined. Now, the fact that this lawyer that he's working with turns out to be the mother of the guy who's the next Batman, his DA is the mother of the guy who's out there breaking the law.
Tanya Fox.
Yeah, Tanya Fox. It's not the most original idea with, having a plot line where you have characters that are very close that don't necessarily know there are secrets, there are motivations, there are, people at odds with each other, not realizing what their relationship is, not realizing, obviously Jace Fox knows that his mom is the DA, but his mom, the DA, Tanya Fox, does not know that her son, Jace Fox, is Batman and she's going after him. So again, it's not the most original idea in the world, but it still works. It's still a way to bring creative tension. It's kind of the most interesting thing that's happened in the story so far. I thought the action was well done. I thought the scenes were okay. We're getting to see Jace play a little bit of the detective here. And also for the first time since going back from when Bruce Wayne lost his fortune to now here, Tim Fox or Jace Fox rather, who's not supposed to have a bunch of resources. We are finally seeing some consequences of that. It's been so much of, Bruce doesn't have a fortune anymore, or Jace Fox is kind of ragtag. But yet they're always able to get the equipment they need or have a safe house or whatever, right? And you're like, man, it must be great to just have unlimited resources. here we actually see him hiding out in some cargo containers and being on the run and not really having a safe haven to go. So that was kind of nice to see as well. I still don't feel like we have a good idea of who exactly he is or what his motivations are. We don't know how he became Batman or any of that sort of thing. And, you know, the bad guys are very much mustache twirling fascist who, you know, like I'm just supposed to dislike them or be against them because they're fascist. And that's supposed to be enough for me. But we don't have any history on how the magistrate came to power or anything like that. So again, it's average, you know, it's not the best thing in the world. It's not the worst thing in the world. My favorite story was actually the second one by Vita Ayala, the Batgirl story with Cassandra Cain and Stephanie Brown. And, you know, at first you think Stephanie Brown has sort of turned her back on the rest of the Bat family. And then come to find out she's been a secret sort of double agent all along who's supposed to be trying to infiltrate this prison that Cass Cain now finds herself in, all to the effect to basically rescue somebody who they know is a big resource for the magistrate, but they don't know exactly who it is. And we see the last page reveal that it's actually Oracle, where she's chained up, tied up some kind of table. There's all these electronic tubes and whatnot. It seems like they're gathering information from her in some way or using her in some way. So I imagine when Vita gets to finish the story, we'll see the Batgirls all come together and rescue the original Batgirl. So I did like that story. I like the fact that in this prison, you know, there are certain rules and there's a lot of other DC characters beyond just the Batgirls that we see there, Cassandra Cain and Stephanie Brown, and the relationships all seem to work. And so I thought that story was pretty good. The Gotham Siren story from Seven Bergen, man, so I was reading this in bed and I fell asleep, I think, three times trying to read the Gotham City Siren story. And granted, it was kind of late, but I didn't fall asleep reading the Batgirl story. it's just my kind of lack of interest. I mean, I am a Catwoman fan, but Poison Ivy's never held much interest for me. And this domestic bot, whatever, first time we're seeing her and the dynamic and whatever. And I didn't think the art was particularly good. Certainly wasn't recognizable as Emanuela Lupacchino, whose art I usually enjoy. So I didn't think it was very good. The most interesting thing about it is the fact that Slam Bradley owns an underground bar in Gotham where people come and former both heroes and villains apparently come and hang out and drink. That was the most interesting thing about it. Other than that, I was just like, I couldn't even tell you. And I read this twice and I couldn't even tell you what the story is really about. It didn't stick with me. That's how not interesting it was to me. So what are your thoughts, Trevor?
I mean, it's so hard because I think upon first reaction, part of me wanted to say that this installment of the next Batman was better than the last, but I'm not super confident on that because in some ways it excels. Well, I don't want to use excels because actually no part of this excels. In some ways it is better than the prior issue, in other ways it is not. I mean, Laura Braga's art, in terms of the design, is a little bit more, well, more than a little bit more polished than Nick Darrington, but boy, it's really super static when it comes to movement. It felt very rigid. When the character was moving, it felt forced. It literally felt like you were trying to take a 2D figure and force it to move. Although I will give her credit in ways that I think Nick Darrington didn't quite succeed in the last one, is that she does better work with camera. She does a good job at identifying visually what beats we need to hone in on throughout the course of the story. Although I felt like her layouts were like kind of just like really run of the mill. Like she identifies how to best shape the panels in order to convey whatever type of movement is going on in the scene or what have you, but it's not really swinging for anything. You know, there are no, and I don't want to say, you know, I don't want to falter because no risks were taken, but it felt real vanilla. in terms of what she's doing visually here. And regarding John Ridley, you know, in some ways we're getting a little bit of sort of necessary internal monologue from Jace, getting a little bit of an idea of his character, his motivations, his sort of shortcomings. But there were moments where it felt like John Ridley added extra internal monologue because he wasn't comfortable letting the art do its work. And I think that was very present here. He forgets that he's working in a visual medium, which is surprising because he comes from film. So it just tells me that there wasn't a lot of trust in the visual artist to convey some of this excess, to convey some of the message that the excess internal monologue did. Now, there were art-wise as well. I don't want to just kind of rag on Laura Braga here. And it could just be up to Nick Darrington's layouts that she didn't choose to stray too far from, but there are some serious like blocking issues. When Batman throws the batarangs, the way he throws them, it looks like he's rolling some jacks, you know, like some jacks and dice. And when you see like in the next panel, and they're trying to convey that they're just basically falling off of the body armor of these magistrate guys, it doesn't look like that at all. Like literally one of them is going in the exact opposite direction that it came from. One of them is going over a guy's head. Another one hasn't even touched anybody. And the whole point was to convey that they're just falling off these guys' body armor. And it actually just looks like everything completely missed, to be quite frank. So there are moments like that where she has a really hard time, again, just identifying what story beats need to be present in moments of action. She's okay in doing that with smaller scenes that are a little bit more conversational or a little bit more sort of focusing on aspect to aspect. But when she's doing action to action storytelling, it doesn't pay off for her well. Also, Jace Fox is kind of a moron. So Batman runs and runs and runs. And the last time that he runs, he's maybe at most 10 feet away from a pack of armed militia with fully automatic guns and decides to run away in a straight line. Does that scream tactician to you, gentlemen? Because it certainly doesn't to me. I mean, especially when two panels later, we have an answer and he throws tactical flash grenades. What stopped you from doing that before you got shot, pal? I don't get it. Right. And then the next scene later, one of the magistrate guys are sort of reiterating what happened. He's like, yeah, this guy tore through us. I was like, I missed that part because it looked like Batman was running away to me. I don't know what we're referring to here, which is kind of ironic because Jace identifies like his shortcomings and the fact that he's kind of an ass Batman. But I feel like it's not in the way that Ridley would want us to believe. Regarding like the drama of the scene, I thought the sort of most successful part, and not saying it was very successful, but most successful by comparison, was this sort of moral balance that Jace has to sort of undergo when deciding how to punish the guilty, trying to identify, you know, how far is too far. How do you gauge the level of punishment, right? When there's a supposed sort of child predator here, knowing he's guilty, but not quite knowing how to dish out the justice that he deserves. You know, with that being said, it was the most successful and most emotionally resonant part of this story. And yet, it wasn't that emotionally resonant. So what does that say about the rest of the book? It's just from a world-class screenwriter, I would just expect so much more. And a lot of the shortcomings in the writing are not a product of switching to medium. It's really not. It's not a pacing issue. It's not an issue of identifying anything like that. These are simple issues in narrative storytelling that John Ridley is just not succeeding in. Moving on in, I guess, into the next story. It was fine. I thought this was probably the best art in the book. Let me give credit where credit's due if I can find the title page. Who did the art in this? Aneke?
Aneke, yeah.
Yeah. I thought some of the sort of gestural work and expressionism was probably the most proficient of this issue. That's not saying a hell of a lot, even though the action was very sort of stunted. You know, dialogue was kind of clunky. I guess I didn't hate this story. I don't know. I guess DC Future State's kind of like lowering the bar. I feel like on any given day, I might be a little bit rougher about this story, but given the sample size, it's not horrible. It's also not good either, if you ask me. Yeah. And then the last story, to be honest with you, not unlike the Superman book, I think by the time I finished the second one, I was just tapped out. I just kind of glazed through it. Didn't really care. Which, again, say what you want about, I guess, my fortitude as a reviewer, but I feel like that's more or less a commentary on the diminishing quality of the DC Future State stories and how they're completely failing to get a reader who is often detail-oriented through the thrust of their stories. So, it is what it is. I wish that I had gotten another installment of Brandon Thomas's Outsiders in this book instead.
All right, Boom, what are your thoughts?
I enjoyed this. I thought the next Batman issue 2, I thought it was really good. I liked the art. I thought the art worked fine for me. I thought it worked pretty well. I thought that John Ridley did a really good job. I think that where I differ from Trevor's criticism is that I thought that the art worked well. And in particular, when he's sort of running away from the guards, that was, I think you have to read that in the context of the narration and the thoughts of Jace Fox as he's running away. He doesn't want to harm them. And he's making that clear. And he takes a bullet and he gets harmed himself. He gets shot himself trying to run away. It's very clear what his objective is. And that is to not harm them. And I thought that worked well. And I thought this, artistically, I was along for the ride. I did think it was a little jarring. I'm very surprised. I would never have guessed Nick Darrington had anything to do with this art, quite frankly. I was definitely more of a Laura Braga. I think Laura Braga's influence was more paramount, but it didn't detract from my enjoyment of the story. I also enjoyed Tanya Fox. And I'm going to once again refer something back to that you said, Trevor, about the difference between the federal and the state officials and the law in our, the earlier comments on another Future State comic. Tanya Fox's job as a lawyer is to actually rewrite the laws, the state laws, in order to justify the fascist militaristic tendencies of the people of Gotham. And her frustration with the magistrate is that he's going ahead and he's implementing these laws. And before they can truly be tested, he's going out and he's sending out the military to enforce it. So I think that's somewhat of an attempt. And dare I say, it's a real world analogy, however unintended it might have been, to what Trump tried to do with respect to immigration and other areas of law in the United States. So frankly, I think it's quite a timely manner. I don't think it was overtly meant to be political, but frankly, I think it's there if one wishes to find it. I actually found that interesting. And it also shows, I love the disconnect between Tanya Fox and clearly her family. I love that Tanya Fox is a passionate lawyer, and she's driven by grief over what happened to her daughter Tammy, who's still in the hospital in a coma. Luke Fox is a genius. Jace Fox isn't as intelligent as his Tim Fox is not as intelligent as Luke Fox, and they also have another sister who is a younger sister who's even smarter than all of them. So I mean, this Fox family, I'm interested in the Fox family. Again, it might be because I'm reading all these particular issues, but overall, I thought it. I was interested in it. I love the sideline. I enjoyed the. I mean, this vigilante parents killing the person who murdered their daughter. It's hard not to sympathize with them. It's interesting that Tim Fox here's Batman in the middle of trying to take down the magistrate. He still finds time to solve an everyday murder. and then he's challenged, you know, with this ethically challenged by how do you punish parents who would murder beat a pedophile to death. I never felt, no, you know, I figured he should have just let them go. But I like that question, that it sort of pose an ethical question to the reader, and that it shows something about Tim Fox is that he still has enough wherewithal, number one, not to kill. He's in the middle of fascist Gotham City and he's choosing not to kill. And he's still wrangling with his demons about ethically about what to do with the parents who would kill the murderer of their daughter. With respect to the second story, Batgirls, I love Cassandra Cain. I love the show up. I love Zaz, Changeling. I love Killer Croc, Big Barda showing up in prison. I love Cassandra Cain showing up and the fact that Spoiler was actually undercover all along. I love the fact that it posed, was it Bruce Wayne? Is it Bruce Wayne? She was called to the prison. There was a beacon in the prison. She saw that there was a Latin term, et vitam. I'm saying it wrong, but E-T-V-I-T-A-M. It's a Latin word. It means and life. That was the signal that was on the computer. And she took that to mean that maybe Bruce Wayne was still alive. So clearly Bruce Wayne is the thread that keeps all these storylines together. Is Bruce Wayne still alive? Is he or isn't he? The mystery of Bruce Wayne, the mythology of Batman / Bruce Wayne, is he alive or not? It's channeling throughout all of Future State. And no more is that more true than Batgirls. I love the final reveal that Oracle is the person who's trapped in the basement. I thought that was nice. However, as much as I like Vito Avila's script, it did drag on. It was too long and it could have been told in about 4 pages instead of the whatever 15 pages it was. Finally, Gotham City Sirens. I don't see the point of this. I love Slam Bradley. He was my favorite part of this story with Gotham City Sirens, but Slam Bradley is a PI. He shouldn't be in this type of narrative. Why isn't Harley Quinn in this? I mean, why do we get a domestic droid DD that acts like a quasi version of Harley Quinn? Why? I don't understand. Why do we need who asked for another character called domestic droid DD? It's the whole thing just, again, it's comedic relief, but I don't think it served a narrative purpose and it contributed nothing to Future State on any level as far as I can see. So that's what I got to say about that.
And that's fine if you want to put in a funny story, but it has to be funny. Like you're putting this in, like it doesn't succeed on any level. Like, you know, you could, and it doesn't need to be Future State. You could have told the story at any time. Still wouldn't be good, whatever era you put it in. That's really the failure of it. I mean, often we say so many times, well, it's not working for this reason or that reason, doesn't fit into this Future State narrative or doesn't fit into this era or that era. The bottom line is if you tell a good story, we're going to enjoy it. And it wasn't good. So
you know what I found ironic is like 9.99 times out of 10, DC will like slap Batman or Harley Quinn on something to sell. And ironically, we get a story where Harley Quinn actually did have a place and they refused to put her in there. That's so ironic.
exactly.
But Boom, I'm curious. I kind of want to pick your brain a little bit about like something you had mentioned about the next Batman, about showing sort of Jace's refusal to kill. And like, I can't get past the fact that, you know, he's maybe 5 to 10 feet away from an armed militia and he gets shot over just throwing the flashbang 5 seconds earlier. I don't know. It comes off more as just like kind of like stupidity on Jace's part rather than, you know, this overwhelming sort of symbolism of him willing to put his body on the line.
Well, he didn't anticipate that there would be backup. First of all, he's not Bruce Wayne. He doesn't have the experience. That's how I took it. He didn't know there'd be backup and he did run through them and he did run away. He was running away from them because he didn't want to use lethal force. That was the whole point. He said he could have taken them out. That was my understanding of what that was about, is that he didn't want to use lethal force because in order to really save himself, he would have had to have killed them. And I do think it was a narrative misstep. And you did point it out, Trevor, that when one of the guards did say that he ran right through us or trash, that wasn't quite an accurate description of what happened. But, you know, I think or in the overall, that didn't take away from my enjoyment of that sequence. I thought it was well laid out and I enjoyed it artistically. I thought it worked and it was an easy read. It flowed well. I thought it had nice pacing. Oh, so far the first two issues of Next Batman, I'm enjoying it. It's an easy to follow narrative. It does read like a TV script, and I guess we can agree to disagree that I think that's a good thing. And I think that at least with the next Batman, those two issues I think are going to read well together.
I don't know, man. That scene, just like the physical blocking of it, really bothered me. And you know, when I look at him, even if he's not Bruce Wayne, he has enough time to process the situation to throw a couple of limp batarangs at people in full body armor. He has enough time to process his restraint. He has enough time to consider running away when he's just feet away from fully armed, fully automated guards. But he doesn't have the foresight to avoid all of that and just throw a flashbang and get out of there. I mean, like when the consideration is to not harm these people, and the first thing you do is throw sharp knives at them, I start to think maybe it's not a super bulletproof excuse when you could have just thrown the flashbang to begin with. I don't know. And I feel like I'm the type that usually fails to see that sort of tactical mentality of stories like this. And if I'm the one pointing that out, I feel like it's rather a shortcoming of the writing. And if this did read like a television script, or if it did read like it was scripted like television, I actually think this would read better than it did, frankly.
I don't know. I'm kind of on Booms. I kind of took it that way. Yeah. It's just lack of experience. When he threw the batarangs, he thought he was up against a certain number of them. And then it turns out there's a lot more. So, you know, he knows they have armor. He knows he's not really going to hurt them with throwing these razor sharp batarangs. Then when all the other guys come up now, it's like, okay, well, the batarangs didn't work. So now I'm already thinking maybe I'm going to have to retreat. There's a lot more of them than I thought. So yeah, let me go ahead and run. As far as not running, you know, running away in a straight line. Yeah. Bad call. Obviously, again, I'm just going to point to lack of, you know, experience doing it. But I didn't really have a problem with it. I mean, it's kind of, there's a lot more other issues I have with it to nitpick on something like that. So I didn't really take it as, you know, that big of a deal. So, but that was just kind of my take on it. So,
yeah. Did anyone else find, actually, I was surprisingly disappointed by the SFX lettering design in this issue. I particularly in that scene, actually, when you're getting the gunfire. I don't know. Maybe I'm just kind of like looking for reasons to not like this now, but I found the special effects lettering design to be really limp.
I never actually. Well, dare I suggest that I would have to go back and look. I didn't even occur to me. I would have to go back and look at it. So are you talking about the Batman story? About the next Batman story?
Yeah, the next Batman. I found the special effects lettering design to be like really weak. I found it like, not only was it just like ineffective, but I actually noticed that it was probably more like distractingly bad than it was anything else.
No, I didn't think there was any problems with the lettering at all. If anything, I felt that the lettering style, specifically the sound effects, they were trying to mirror the art, which, you know, like I said, the art is okay. Here's the thing. When you're taking Laura Braga's art and you're putting it over Nick Darrington layouts, you're not getting the best of either of them. So to me, the art, while okay, it aesthetically it's okay, but it could have been a lot better. I'll just put it that way. And so I think Clayton Cowles, the letterer, was kind of hamstrung by that.
And good point.
If there was anything design wise that I didn't like, it's also all the panels have like these double thick, really heavy black borders.
Yeah.
I also thought was an interesting choice. It gives the book this static feel that I didn't necessarily think worked. So
I
thought the art was a little inconsistent, but yeah, I didn't have any problem with the lettering.
I think what you're saying too there about the page design, like calling it static, I think is the perfect word for like visually what's happening in this book. And you notice too, now that you bring out the panel borders, there's like nothing done with panel gutters at all. Like there's no mindfulness of the composition of the page in the slightest.
So, and here's the thing that I'll say in defense of these artists. I guarantee that Nick Darrington has never done layouts before, and Laura Braga has probably never done finishes. They're used to doing the whole thing themselves, you know, whether it's just doing it in pencils and then someone else inks it, or they're just working digitally. So, you know, if I point to anybody as the reason behind the art not being as good as it could be, it probably editorial, DC editorial. It's clear to me. It is so clear to me that these creators were rushed. You know, they might as well have had somebody standing over them with a whip based on the subpar art we're seeing from artists that we know can do a better job. So anyway, that's more than enough about the next Batman number two. I will never read that book again. I'm sick of hearing about it. Beat that thing to death. So let's move on to Wonder Woman, Immortal Wonder Woman number one, written by Becky Cloonan and Michael W. Conrad. They're, as I said, going to be the writers on the Immortal Wonder Woman that's going to start up for Infinite Frontier. The art and the colors are done in the first story by Jen Bartel, and letters are by Pat Brusseau. We do have a backup story. It's Nubia in Future State, written by L.L. Kinney. The art is by Aletha Martinez, inks by Mark Morales, and colors by Emilio Lopez. Why don't you go first, Boom? What do you think about this one?
Well, you know what? I did do my own review of this week too on my channel. And when it comes to Immortal Wonder Woman, I went a little bit on a rant on Wonder Woman, because I'm more frustrated with the characterization that Becky Cloonan gives Diana here. I love Yara Flor, the new Brazilian Wonder Woman. She's amazing. I actually think that the backup here with Nubia as Wonder Woman is more interesting than Diana here. And it's frustrating to me. I love Nubia. I love Yara Flor. I wish Diana would reflect a little bit more of the intelligence and the wisdom of Athena that she's purportedly supposed to have. She's immortal. This is apparently taking place at the end of time. And she's just as dumb as she was when she left Themyscira all those millennia ago. It's just, it's frustrating to me. Now, having said that, I think Jen Bartel's art is, I think it's absolutely beautiful. Now, is it appropriate to this story? When you're drawing Darkseid in a battle at the end of time, I don't think it is, but I have to say, man, the art was beautiful. I don't think there are pages here when she's walking through the Batcave talking to Batman. I don't think it's appropriate that Anna would cry talking to a hologram of Batman, but it is beautiful. I really do. I think the art is beautiful on the page where it has the title page with Wonder Woman in Future State. It mentions all the artists. It really is beautiful. The backgrounds, the colors just pop off the page. Kudos to color art. I was going to shout out the colorist here.
She colors. Jen colors herself.
Well, and I guess you can tell it really looks beautiful. Having said that, it does have a little bit of a static nature. This is the first time I've ever seen Jen Bartel ever draw a really genuine hardcore action scene. And it seems you can tell she struggles with it a little bit. I think that her dark side looks like it almost looks like the Thing from the Fantastic Four. It's like, her dark side is a little different, but she's using, it almost looks like the palette she's using for her art. It almost looks like a painted on effect. I don't know what it is, but this is a beautiful looking comic. I really enjoyed the visuals on this. The story wise though, I'm not going to, story wise, I just don't know what the hell's going on. It's the end of time. What are you saving? Like, humanity is dead. Everyone's dead. Why are you trying to save Swamp Thing? Why does it matter? The Amazons aren't even on Earth. Nubia is probably dead by now, because this is, I'm assuming, sometime in the far future. I didn't really know what was going on. Again, it was a beautiful mess. Who cares? Darkseid was the smartest character in this story. He was the smartest one. Darkseid is like laughing at, why is an old Superman attacking Darkseid? Let Darkseid do what he wants. Even Apocalypse was destroyed. But at least Darkseid has the wherewithal to realize it. Who cares? It's the end of the Earth. It's the end of time. Let's go to another universe or multiverse and start all over. I don't know what Wonder Woman's trying to save here. I guess she's trying to get Swamp Thing on another planet to revitalize the green. But why? I don't know. Of all this, all of us have read multiple times in preparing for these podcasts that we do, We've read all this. I don't know how this has any connection to Future State. Why is it important that this story exists? This just to me seems like a disparate one shot. Again, I enjoyed it for what it is. Anytime Wonder Woman wants to fight Darkseid, man, I'm in. Okay. And this was a treat for me. I enjoyed it in that respect, but narratively, I'm shaking my head. This is a beautiful mess. It's a beautiful mess, but it is a narrative mess. And Becky Cloonan, I know Becky Cloonan is a better writer than this. I've read her indie work. Her DMZ. I mean, she's a good writer, but this was a mess. I really like the Nubia story. I love the show. I love Grail. And I loved that. To me, was a much more interesting tale. The fact it gave us some history of the Amazons, that the Amazons at one point created this key that had multiversal power, and it was broken up into 9 fragments. And Grail is trying to obtain all these fragments. She's already obtained 8. So rather than a long drawn out treasure hunt, Grail already has 8. She's trying to get the 9th piece. Nubia stops her. But this one piece ends up infecting Nubia, and we meet Nubia's aunt Nancy, who runs a nightclub, and it's actually kind of interesting. As a reader of Wonder Woman, I'm actually curious to know who's this, what's the secrets of this of her aunt, what connections, what's her history exactly, what's Grail's agenda here ultimately. There was a screw up, which I'll let Trevor comment on. there was definitely an editorial screw up there with some of the dialogue. It looks like they put the dialogue screwed up on one of the pages. But I have to say, artistically, Nubia looks gorgeous. L.L. McKinney was the writer on the Nubia story. Aletha Martinez, I thought her art was excellent. Again, somewhat of a pointless Wonder Woman tale, but I'm glad we're getting some Nubia love. I'm liking everything but Diana. I love Nubia, and I love Yara Flor, and I'll leave it at that.
All right, Trevor, your thoughts?
Boy, I couldn't disagree with you more. This was easily the worst book of the week, easily one of the worst Future State books I've read so far. Jen Bartel is not made to do interior comic book art. From the first page, I looked at Diana walking through the Batcave and I thought, gee, it looks like you have 2 different artists doing the background and the foreground. The figure literally looks like you took a sticker of Diana and put it in front of the Batcave. Like it's so disjointed. It's super rigid. The artwork, very static. Also for clarification, I got the impression that she was talking to Batman's spirit somehow, given that there's like these weird little wisps coming off of his blue Batman astral projection, whatever the hell that was. I thought first of all, it was so slow up until they just crammed a bunch of action for action's sake in at the end. This super sentimental Diana is not the badass warrior princess that I know her to be. Rather than collecting her allies' tools in order to use them against Darkseid, she's doing them for sentimental reasons, which makes me think this immortal warrior princess has never fought in a war, has never considered battle tactics or planning. So you have a Green Lantern ring. You have the utility belt of, in Superman's own words, the most dangerous man on the planet. And you grab them to cry about it. Cool. Awesome. Good job. This was also flooded with a bunch of really thinly metaphorical internal monologue. And regarding dialogue as well, it was super choppy, lacked cadence. It literally just felt like words falling out of somebody's mouth because we needed some explanation here. And through the dialogue and the monologue, the themes are thrown on with the utmost of ham. We're told how we should feel as opposed to generating the feeling through the narrative and the visual presentation of the book. And at times I felt like the internal monologue that's explaining how we should feel was just, there was just as much of that as there was visual art, which is just this unnecessary imbalance here. the shifts in Diana's character motives are incongruent. One second she wants to stay totally out of it. The next second she's all for fighting and for the conflict. Again, Jen Bartel's art is relatively uninspired. There are a few miscellaneous panels here that are absolutely gorgeous. And there are a few panels here that are absolutely horrendous. The minute you shift to Apocalypse, the color palette was not well blended. The character figure design was exponentially worse than any other part of the book. They felt like children's stickers. We get two pages of Darkseid flying throughout space, looking like he's straight out of Dragon Ball Z, except, again, super rigid. It was poorly done. It was a poorly done story. There's maybe one solid page where Diana gives her battle cry to the rest of the Amazons, where the color was actually well blended. The layout actually did its job, but in almost every other instance, it did not feel like I was viewing a professional comic book artist's work, let alone Jen Bartel, who does beautiful covers, but I would never want to read her on interior art ever again. Regarding the Nubia story, this was even worse, to be quite frank. The art felt like the epitome of sloppy 90s Image comics, where I'll give the artists a little bit of credit, is at least that you could tell they really went out of their way to try to make the layout exciting, but they tried way too hard. Almost every page they have a figure breaking the panel boundaries. It becomes less special every time you do it. And regarding panel borders, they're actively trying to use these very jagged, non-planar lines in order to give panels depth and movement, but they start to do like these weird like scribbles on the outside of the panels during fight scenes. It just becomes like where I have issue with some artists not giving any thought to their page layout and design. I feel like this artist just tried way too hard and came up short. Even the moments of action just felt, it felt like we were watching this in a series of, I mean, it felt like a series of static images. I got no sense of movement. And on that dialogue, again, super choppy. Don't quite know what's going on most of the time in the fight. And as Rocky sort of alluded to, there's a page where none of the word balloons are matching. The tails are going this way, that way, the other way. And a lot of it is actually dialogue from the prior page. There's also something that I know we didn't talk about prior. I don't know if this was the letterer again, or I'm led to believe it's the letterer based on the last mistake. They recaption the location, even though we never changed locations. So when you get the establishing shot of the museum, it says Atlanta, Michael C. Carlos Museum. In that page with the aforementioned sort of directionless word balloons, they establish the location again, unnecessarily, even though we never moved locations. We never shifted perspective to another location, but they feel the need to caption the location again, which I just felt was inherently indicative to how sloppy this story was. It felt run of the mill, cool. Nubia meets Knight at the museum. Awesome. Which is kind of a shame because I was excited for a Nubia story. Choppy dialogue, poor pacing, gives me nothing to care about. Half the conversation she has with her Aunt Nancy is her reiterating in poor dialogue fashion what we've already seen. It was drab. I'm not going near Immortal Wonder Woman number 2. Not going to go near Clunin's Wonder Woman run. Hopefully Joelle Jones continues a Yara Floor series so I can get my dose of Wonder Woman. But that's those are my thoughts.
Yeah, so I'm like so far away from where you guys are. Well, certainly in terms of Yara Floor, she far and away is the most boring Wonder Woman to me. I can't stand her. So what I've seen so far makes me not want to read anything that has anything to do with her. Diana here, yeah, are there problems? Yes. The whole thing of her not wanting to fight, and, you know, again, she's a warrior princess. I get it. She's dejected. She's depressed. Everybody that she's ever loved is gone. So I can kind of see it. But then for her to flip around once her sister stubbornly refused to leave the earth. Yeah, it doesn't make a whole heck of a lot of sense. But she does, you know, fight Darkseid in the end. And I guess, okay, like Diana toe-to-toe with Darkseid would normally be pretty good. Except, yeah, you guys are right. Jen Bartel is not the right choice for artist for this story. Her Darkseid does look like a gray thing. But Nubia, she's quickly become my favorite Wonder Woman. I love the second story. I thought it was done really well. Is it perfect? No, by no means is it perfect. Yeah, the dialogue is a little repetitive at times. Did we all read? So I just read my preview copy. I didn't, the press preview copy. I didn't see an actual printed copy. So keep in mind that the thing like the double location and the word balloons being on the wrong page, you know, I got this like 3 weeks ago. So this isn't the final that went to press. So has anybody seen the final, and can you confirm that those word balloons were in the wrong place? Because usually something like that will get play, at least on Bleeding Cool. You know, they like to call out mistakes like that. So I only read the press copy, so I don't know if it got corrected before it went to print. So hopefully it did. But you're right, Trevor, it is indicative of and to my point earlier, how much this stuff has been rushed out. Get it out, get it out, get it out. They're not paying enough attention, and you're getting mistakes like that where a location is indicated twice, or you have the wrong word balloons on the wrong page. You know, mistakes happen. You know, that's fine. We're all human. So I didn't necessarily have a problem with that. Obviously, you want to make sure that those mistakes don't happen. And a quick read through will show you that, hey, something's wrong here. So, but as far as the actual technical stories and the art, yeah, I kind of liked it. I did have some problems with the Wonder Woman story, mainly, again, that Jen's art, and I've seen her do interiors before. And do I think she's the best interior artist in the world? No, but I do agree with Boom that her art is always beautiful. But it does seem more like a series of snapshots rather than sequential art. The place where she has the most room for improvement is her transitions, to make it actually look like, you know, this action follows the, you know, previous action from this panel rather than just a series of mini pinups over and over. But it does look beautiful. And the fact that she does her own colors, it's very good. She does have a certain style, and that comes through here. And I think it's a gorgeous book to look at, except when you get to Darkseid, the character design there just doesn't work for me. And yeah, and the story just felt kind of like sort of pedestrian, didn't make a whole lot of sense other than to convey the fact that poor Diana has lost everybody that she cares about. Okay. And I feel like I wanted more. And I feel like when you talk about the Nubia story, I did get more. At least it had, you know, we saw Grail. We were told what was going on. It had a, you know, an actual narrative and an actual plot, and things actually move forward. Is it perfect? No. You know, there is some repetitiveness in the dialogue, like I mentioned. But yeah, at least I thought, hey, Nubia is at least interesting. You know, I'm at least learning something. Whereas to me, Yara Flores is just not working for me. She's been, you know, in three different books that I've read so far, her characterization's been all over the place. I don't even know who she is. I didn't care for the Joelle Jones story at all, not even a little bit. I felt like, wait, this is a character that's supposed to have been Wonder Woman for years and years, and it feels like she belongs on like the Teen Titans or Justice League Junior. I'm not buying her as a, you know, experienced hero. So I guess we'll see. But yeah, I like the Nubia story. Again, the art wasn't perfect either, but I thought Aletha Martinez did, you know, a relatively good job. I thought the line work was handled really well. There are some issues with anatomy here and there and perspective, but you know, there's things that you can improve on over time. So yeah, I vehemently disagree that this is the worst Future State book. It doesn't come close to being the worst Future State book in my mind. I'd read this over and over before I had to read about Dick Stroke again, you know, every day and twice on Sunday. So, but again, I didn't hate the art. I'm a fan of Jen Bartel. And I would point to her work on her creator owned series that she does at Image with Sam Humphrey's Blackbird, where she does the interiors there. And, you know, it does suffer from a little bit of the same sort of weakness, you know, it's those transitions, but again, it's a beautiful book. The colors are great. Like it's emotional in a different way. It's not because of the transitions or the sequence, but because of the color that she puts on these beautiful images that evokes emotion. So yeah, I agree. She's not the best interior artist, but she has her style and she certainly has her following. And I don't expect her to go away anytime soon, but I also don't expect her to do interior work on a regular basis. She is basically a cover artist, and you know, you can make more doing multiple covers a month than you can doing a monthly book. So, you know, why wouldn't you? Mm. All right, let's move on. Let's go ahead and do Nightwing. And we'll start with you, Trevor. What are your thoughts on Nightwing?
Finally, something I can be relatively positive about. Thank the gods. Yeah, this was a fine story. I'm not gonna say this was anything incredible, but boy, was this just a brush of fresh air in the overall context of Future State. You know, there's some pretty solid plotting in here and a conveyance of character and the new context, both sort of mentally, emotionally, and physically for Dick Grayson. The dialogue is a little bit inconsistent here, fairly high highs in the delivery, but there are also times where the writer doesn't know how to pull back and just ride off of the solid bits of dialogue. He begins to sort of over deliver. And if he had a better sense of the temperature, I feel like he would have known when to let good dialogue rest and maintain its impact. There's a great pacing. I think the pacing was the best part of this story and development of the personal stakes that are going to supposedly ride into the greater context of Gotham in Future State. Nicola Scott does a pretty good job. I don't think this is as good as what I'm used to from Nicola Scott, to be quite frank. But, you know, Nicola Scott on one of her worst days is still better than most other artists. It's generally solid, although something that I find sort of unclear is that I get this sense that Nightwing is hallucinating when he's looking at the computer screen in the cave, although there's a moment in the art where it just looks like the transmission is ending. So I don't know. It's maybe that's just me making something out of nothing, but to give Scott compliments, she has this really dramatic use of camera angle and shot size. She's very much instinctive and knows when and where to be in the scene and how to show that. So I give her a lot of credit. It's overall just, it's a solid story, man. Like it's a solid like 7 out of 10. I'm not mad at it. It's not incredible, but you know, it's one of the few Future State books that I look at and I'm like, you know what? I actually want to read issue 2 rather than feeling like I need to. So, you know, I'd call that in the wider context of Future State a glowing success.
Wow, that's sad that a 7 is a glowing success. What are your thoughts, Boom?
Well, let me just start off. I would give this easily a 9 out of 10. This is, for me, this is the best Nightwing comic that's come out in the last, I would say, probably 10 years. The most, as far as a single issue of Nightwing, this is Dick Grayson at arguably his finest. He's tactically brilliant. He's kept his humanity despite being put down. He's kick-ass. And he's also a little bit, he's more hardcore. I mean, I love it at the beginning there when he rescues that couple and he sees right away from their body language that they're not really victims. And he throws his little club and he hits the one guy in the chin. He knows they're full of shit. He knows, he sees it coming. And it's written so well that, you know, Andrew Constant, I don't know what his background is, but man, I'm impressed because I went through most of the issue thinking that Peacekeeper 1 and Peacekeeper 6, that they had pulled the wool over Nightwing's eyes, that they were setting him up for a trap. But in fact, it was the other way around. Nightwing wants to kick ass. He wants to pull them into Arkham Asylum where his headquarters are, and he wants to take them out once and for all. He's, you know, this is, I love this. This whole thing had an epic feel to me. And not only that, even for fans that are just into Nightwing because he's got a hot body and an ass. I mean, there's even a shower scene with Nightwing, for God's sakes, and Batman shows up. And Nightwing makes Batman, you know, Tim Fox. He's more experienced than Jace Fox is. And you could tell. And there's just, I love the respect that that writer Andrew Constant shows Dick Grayson in this story. It's just, there's a great deal of respect, and he's such an iconic character, and he's written so well. And the highest compliment that I can give, is that this is now not only the best comic book so far of Future State, but it elevates the other comic books of Future State such that I'm now actually curious to know how this Nightwing turned into the Dick Grayson that we read in Teen Titans. And Teen Titans Future State was arguably one of the worst Future State titles we've read so far. But now I'm actually curious to know how this Nightwing becomes the bitter dick stroke that we saw in Teen Titans. That's the highest compliment that I can give about this story. And Nicola Scott, I'll agree with Trevor that the that it's not her best, but it's, I mean, Nicola Scott, even at her not best, is still really good. I'm just so impressed. I love that it's Arkham Asylum. I love where he has his headquarters. I love that the shower scene sounds like I'm talking about a porn, but the shower scene with Batman when he shows up and the conversation that they have and the whole, everything just really comes together really well. And it ends with that, you know, looking forward to that siege of Arkham Asylum, the next issue. I'm looking forward to this. This put a great big smile on my face, and yeah, I'm glowing after this.
Yeah, I thought it was really good also. So Andrew Constant, I've met him before, he's been on the show. He's from Australia, just like Nicola is actually. So he's done work down there. He's done previous work for DC. If you're curious, he did the Demon miniseries a few years ago with Brad Walker on art. That was a lot of fun. So yeah, and he's a real fun-loving guy. So I like Andrew a lot. So yeah, I mean, I agree. This is like, okay, you wonder where Bruce Wayne went? Well, apparently Dick Grayson is channeling Bruce Wayne because, you know, like Boom said, he's getting a little more hardcore. You know, usually Dick is more to the optimist, you know, the breath of fresh air, the look to the brighter side of things and kind of easy going and let things sort of roll off of him. He's fed up. He's fed up with the magistrate. He's fed up with the state of things. And yeah, he's laid his trap and he's done it well. So the fact that we're getting to see Dick Grayson sort of level up and channel Bruce in terms of, you know, taking a tactical advantage and turning the tables on the magistrate is great. I'll echo what you guys said about Nicola's art. Yeah, it's probably her at 90% or 85% instead of 100%, unlikely because, like I said, she was rushed. I know I actually talked to her a few weeks ago and she was mentioning how she was under a massive deadline. And this was probably longer than a few weeks ago. It was probably right around the 1st of December, actually. So I'm sure she was working on this and, you know, they weren't given a lot of time to turn things around is my guess from, you know, the quality that we've seen in the art. But yeah, I mean, I echo a lot of what Boom and Trevor said. Dick, you know, reading right away that this was a trap and it was a setup and just being ahead of things. And we're going to, you know, flip the script and say, okay, well, now all of a sudden Nightwing is mentoring Batman as opposed to Batman mentoring Dick when he was Robin, when he first took on the costume. So I find that to be interesting as well. So yeah, I'm looking forward to the next issue of Nightwing. And I guess we'll have to wait and see what happens. And the whole Nightwing butt thing, Nick started that. It was her drawing him in the first place. Yeah. So I know there's some debate online about it. And even talking about Tom Taylor's upcoming Nightwing book and, you know, people saying it kind of diminishes Dick to talk about him as a sex symbol or whatever. And I just want to say to those people that have a problem with it, get over yourselves. It's comics. It's not, this isn't, you know, cancer. We're not curing cancer here. If people like Dick because he's got a cute butt and he fights crime, then what, you know, that doesn't negatively affect your life. If you don't go in for that thing and see him as a sex symbol, then fine. Then don't see him that way. You can still read the comic and take from it what you enjoy. Like there's no reason to shit on anybody else because they like things a certain way. It's all fun. We're just all having fun here, you know? And some people like to make Nightwing butt jokes, big deal. I mean, we make the dick stroke joke every time we talk about Teen Titans, which for the record, is the worst future state title, not Immortal Wonder Woman. So anyway, let's move on to the last book. I'm going to go first because I have a feeling that I didn't like this one as much as you guys did. It's Catwoman. It's written by Ram V. We have Otto Schmidt on art. The color work is, let me find the page. Well, the color work's by Otto Schmidt as well, which is no surprise. Mm-hmm. He usually does color his own stuff. And then Tom Napolitano on colors. I'll talk about the art first. So I fell in love with Otto Schmidt's work when he was doing Green Arrow, when Benjamin Percy was writing it. Because he was doing all the art just like this, you know, he's doing the pencils, he's doing the digital inks, he's coloring it, and it's his vision. And it was absolutely spectacular. And it blew me away month in, month out. This doesn't do that. And again, I have no choice but to think it's because they rushed him. It just, I don't know. It doesn't jump off the page the way his art does for me normally. It's not bad by any means. And his storytelling is still top notch. And his camera angles are still great, his transitions, but it's missing that certain something that I expect from Otto Schmidt art that elevates it from good to great. So I'd say the art in this issue is good, but it's not great. It's not. And again, that's just, you know, me expecting more because I've seen Otto Schmidt deliver more in the past. As far as the story itself, I thought it was fine. You know, kind of the whole idea, and even the name of the story, the Great Train Robbery. And that's what we're seeing here of Catwoman, you know, basically jumping onto this moving train and sort of trying to fight her way up to the front of the train to rescue this all important prisoner that the magistrate has imprisoned. And we, you know, find it's Bruce Wayne, which there may be some editorial and timeline problems with that, but I'll let Trevor talk about that. It didn't even register to me when I read it the first time. So yeah, I liked it, but I would say I didn't enjoy this as much as I'm enjoying what Ram V is doing on his current Catwoman run, which to me reminds me of the best things about a Michael Mann film. But this reminds me of a fun popcorn action movie as well. But it's not quite as interesting, probably because I know it's only two issues, and what really can you do? So I thought it was good, but not great. So kind of the same way I feel about the art is how I feel about the story. And only because it just, as fun as it was, I just, in the back of my mind, I'm like, okay, and how much can we get with one more issue? Which is a problem I'm having with all the Future State books, to be honest. You know, how much can we really get? And then when you talk about, well, but it's a great jumping on point for anybody, right? Because you don't need to have read anything that comes before. None of these, let's be honest here, none of these Future State books are made to where somebody who's never read a DC comic can jump on this stuff. They'd be even more lost than us. And we're supposedly are the experts. So I'm not buying that argument that, hey, you don't need to have read anything. No, you know what you need to have read? You need to have read like every DC comic ever printed to try to make sense of this, and it still won't make sense to you. So I'm not necessarily buying that. I'm coming more and more around to the point that Boom has made all along, that these future jumps, these glimpses into the future, they just don't work. Like, unless you're going to devote a significant amount of time, at least six issues, so that you have time to actually establish a story and a narrative and a timeline, or the point that Trevor's made multiple times before where, hey, why didn't you give us a Bible? Why didn't you give us kind of some kind of one shot? Why didn't you give us some kind of story that establishes here's what the hell's going on, you know? It's just a failure, and I have to, I'm not going to point the finger at the creators to take all the blame on this. To me, this falls on editorial or even higher up than that. The people that are giving the directions to editorial, whoever decided, okay, we're going to go ahead and repurpose 5G to Future State and put out the material that we paid for. Great. You paid for it. You want to put it out. I get it. It's got to be done better than this. You can't just, you know, is this lifer just going, just put it out. Those dumbass comic fans will buy it because it says Batman on it. So, I mean, that's kind of where I'm coming around. And I don't know. I worry that a year from now, 18 months from now, I'm going to be buying like the fewest number of DC titles I have in maybe 20 years. So, you know, reading Catwoman, and as much as I'm enjoying the regular season or regular series, like I mentioned, and then seeing this, and this was the last book that I read for the week. And then I was reflecting on the week, and, you know, I was just kind of thinking, man, this stuff just each week goes by. And granted, they've slowly for me have been creeping up in quality overall. The first week for me was the worst one. And this one's a little better than week two was, but you know, it's not increasing at a level that's giving me any confidence that this stuff's going to be anything but garbage. It's going to be Convergence 2.0. And the only reason any of the books will have any value is if they happen to have a first appearance. Yara Ford and her big Brazilian booty will want to buy that, you know. So
we love a thick Wonder Woman.
Yeah. All right. Give us your thoughts, Boom. What do you think?
I think this is Ram V's best Catwoman story so far, and I know he's been writing the regular series. I love this. I give this the same scores I gave Nightwing. It's so hard. I'm trying to pick which one I love more. I love it. This embodies everything about Catwoman. It even builds on her mythology. It starts off with these kids being loaded onto trains to be taken to a reformatory because they're not obeying the laws that the magistrate has put forward. And I love that they're building on the mythology of her stray cats. This is in the future. So all the stray cats, those orphans of and those people of the streets that don't have a home, they, you know, they look to Selina Kyle as their de facto leader, and they even have their own hand signals, which was hinted at. It's just so cool. And the idea is they, you know, she wants to free them. And so it's this great train heist. And, you know, even the action sequence and Otto Schmidt on the art, it could be better, but you know, honestly, it works. I get where it's coming from. The Cheshire Cat, another sidekick called Leo. She flies, whether it's a motorcycle, lands on the train, and she's got new technology for her suit, which looks kind of cool. I just, all this in 22 pages, so much, and this was paced so well. And artistically, the way that the design was, I really thoroughly enjoyed this. This was just, I felt like this was a great train heist. And the breath of fresh air of Onomatea, did I say that right? Onomatea?
Onomatopoeia?
Onomatopoeia. Onomatopoeia. Onomatopoeia.
I just want to say that I live for the way you pronounce things, man. Yeah. So you do you.
I know I butchered it on my review. I said it 1,000 times, and I don't think I said it right once, and I still haven't. But in any event, he gives sound effects, and I sound like I'm giving sound effects when I try to pronounce his name. What a wonderful addition to this story out of the blue. And Selina stumbles upon him. He helps her escape. He helps her obtain her objectives. With Talia showing up, Talia Al Ghul, she's the actual person who's actually undercover, and Bruce Wayne is in fact on the train, and I don't know how this syncs up with where Bruce Wayne is in the other timelines exactly, so I'm not really sure how that all lines up, but I'm just overall I just had a lot of fun here. Between the sidekicks, the misdirection, even though the way they portray the magistrates underlings there, I almost got like an empire feel. Like this is like the Empire Strikes Back, and they're all dressed so regally and like empire and militaristic, and it's perfect for Selina to make a scene and to pull off a heist. I had a lot of fun, and there's another issue of this. I'm really enjoying this. I think Ram V did a good job. And frankly, the fact that my criticisms of this issue really aren't the fault of the issue. It's the fault of Future State in general. Mm. Jumping right in on this, I enjoyed this. I actually felt that if I didn't know more about the story, that's okay. I could actually sit back and enjoy this. It reminds me of like late at night when you put the TV on and you're smack dab in the middle of a movie you haven't seen before, but you're in act two or act three, and it's great action. You don't exactly know how you got there, but you're enjoying the movie. That's what I felt like reading this comic.
Yeah. So Onomatopoeia is actually a Kevin Smith creation. He's a Green Arrow villain. And it's funny, like Smith didn't want anybody else using him because he had plans for him. And DC even asked a couple times, hey, so-and-so wants to use, no, I'm going to come back to DC Comics and tell a story with him. Then he never ended up doing it. So we haven't seen him for a long time.
He did the same thing with Bullseye at Marvel.
Yep. Yep. So, you know, just too many ideas. It happens to a lot of creators, too many ideas, and not enough time in the day to get them all taken care of. The other thing that I'll mention, so Boom mentioned kind of the young kids on the train and the kind of the strays. The fact that part of the reason this succeeds so well is the fact that you got the writer who's writing the current Catwoman series, Ram V, where those lost strays are a big part of the regular series that's going on. And so for him to carry that theme to this also, you know, I thought it, I didn't mention it, but yeah, it does work really well. What are your thoughts, Trevor?
This is easily the best book of the week. This is a competitor for the best book in all of Future State by far. I haven't been reading Ram V's Catwoman, and this actually makes me, this is the only DC Future State book that is pointing me towards reading anything else. Like this is making me want to go back, reread Ram V's Catwoman, because there are so many small seamless narrative tricks that Ram V pulls off. First of all, the world building, right? We're put into this context that is seemingly disconnected and connected in many ways to the greater sort of landscape of Future State Gotham. And the sort of metaphorical and narrative confines of Catwoman building her pack of strays to resist against Future State, I think is brilliant. I think she makes, Ram V makes these very sort of subtle commentaries on the pavement to prison pipeline for children, that being, you know, one of the carts housed in the train being transported to this detention center, like seamless. He's able to pull off the idea that this has all been established organically without telling me too much about it, letting the art do its do all of the letting the art do all the work that it needs to do, so that when by the time we're using dialogue and we're using internal monologue, it's setting up other things or it's evolving on what's already been presented. This is one of the only books where I think a writer has shown that off competently. And I give him very, 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 very high marks for that. There's this great development of tension through the opening scene in particular that I think is great. Feels like I'm reading, again, like you said, a Michael Mann movie, but I think with a little bit more thematic panache. He puts in a lot of work to establish this narrative of Selina and the current Gotham. Easily the sharpest dialogue in all of Future State. This is the only book, if you guys have noticed, that I haven't made a comment about dialogue, because it's good. It's good. There's a cadence. Characters sound like different people. In fact, the characters sound individual. The dialogue also puts in enough work to provide proper exposition without being about exposition. The only writer in all of Future State to do that. There's, like I said, super effective world building, great brisk pace. You know, it was high energy, an excellent show of Selina, her character, behavior through dialogue and gestures. I thought it was a great retooling of a sort of classic heist plot. It's not overly original, but I think putting it in the context of this Future State Gotham and in DC Comics in general and using the sort of little characteristics of characters that we do know in order to put those spins on it, I thought were particularly good. The twist at the end with Bruce being one of the captives, I think, was particularly solid, but it does raise a lot of questions about the sort of connective tissue as to what's going on with Bruce Wayne and what's happening with him in general. But it was good. And I can't blame Ram V, because there have been editorial consistencies throughout DC. So like Jace, I tend to point my finger at DC's poor editorial. Regarding art, you know, let me know if I'm overstepping, but Jace, I get the sense that what is throwing you off is that the lines aren't super clean. I've noticed you're very big on very clean, tight line work. And while I don't think Otto Schmidt's line work was the cleanest we've seen from him, I think his visual storytelling was so good that I'm very much willing to forgive the sort of lack of tightness or the looseness in the line work. The layouts were super inspired, hyper effective at conveying action, or those small moments of the Selina's sort of uprising or her coup. One of the only artists in Future State, I just made this complaint about the artist from Nubia. This is one of the only artists I've actually seen be able to break the panel borders multiple times on the same page and have it not be overwhelming, and to have it actually be effective at pushing tone. Honestly, phenomenal character work. He really pins the tone of every moment down packed. And like I said, I think visually I'm willing to forgive a little bit of that loose penciling for the sake of how brilliant the visual storytelling was. I mean, seriously, bang up job in that way.
Yeah. I mean, and I would be too, if it was here or there. And that's my point, you know, like I'm assuming you never read his work on Green Arrow with Benjamin.
No, I did. That's what introduced me to his work.
Yeah. So when I see, you know, consistent greatness over and over and over, then I come to expect that from the artist. And yeah, it doesn't mean every single issue they do has to rise to that level. And if they have a mistake here or a mistake there, but when it's consistent in the style that, as you said, it's not as tight, I can't help but notice it. And it does pull me out of the story because I'm not blown away. Whereas like literally every other Otto Schmidt book I've ever read, I've been blown away. You know, so you come to have expectations. And again, I'm bringing it to there, and by no means am I blaming Otto for this. Again, I think you point the finger at editorial. Everything I'm learning, everything I'm hearing from creators, everything I'm seeing with my own eyes is telling me that these guys had no time. And so, yeah, the work's going to suffer, but I'm not going to sit here and say that I didn't notice it, you know? So yeah, but it keeps the book from being like a 9 out of 10, you know, because the art's just not as good as it could be, you know?
Yeah. I don't know if this is even necessarily a 9 out of 10 for me. You know, I'd put it somewhere between an 8 and an 8.5, depending on rereading, but that's still, I mean, that's the best grade I've given any of the Future State books. See, I think that the thing is, and I've noticed too with you, you're very into the clean line work and clean design, where I'm willing to forgive issues in design for what we're doing with the sequential narrative, how we're telling the story visually. And I like I said, it was the Rebirth Green Arrow that introduced me to Otto Schmidt, and the art is absolutely brilliant. But I actually think what he's doing with layout and camera here is better than anything he did in Green Arrow. I think the strengths in the Green Arrow art were obviously the cleanliness of the design. And he does some really great stuff emotively and gesturally, particularly between like Ollie and Dinah and Ollie and Emiko. But just around this book, man, visually, he's excelling at telling the story, conveying tone, action, movement. If a comic book artist, you know, or a fledgling comic book artist were to ever comment on my channel and ask me about a recent book to learn how to visually tell a story, I would point them towards this, because it's so well done. And it, in that way, although the design was a little bit looser, the I don't want to say the cinema of it, because this was so inherently comic booky, but the visual capabilities of Otto Schmidt telling the story were just firing on all cylinders.
Yeah, it just didn't do it for me like the way that it hit you, you know. And yeah, you're right. I do usually prefer much cleaner line work, but that's not to say that I you know, don't like art that's a little looser. The problem I have with the art here is normally his work is tighter, and here it's looser. So to me, that's a step in the wrong direction, and I'm going to have to call that out. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is in his Green Arrow run, if you remember, there specifically was an issue where Ollie and Dinah go and have an adventure on a train
heist. Yeah.
And yeah. To me, that art is more dynamic, especially the color work, and the lines are tighter. And so to me, you know, if I put them side by side, I'm going to like that artwork and that storytelling better than this. But again, that's just a personal, you know.
Did Otto do the colors in those back then? Didn't he have another?
Nope. Yep. He did it. So it was him and Juan Ferreira and Stephen Byrne. The three of them traded off arcs, and all three of them did all the, whether it was Byrne or Schmidt or Ferreira, they did everything, which made for some really incredible art on that book.
Yeah.
It was criminally underrated.
On that, I do kind of just want to give him some credit on the coloring of the book. I think he has an overwhelmingly solid awareness of the palette that he's using, and how to use the palette to accent very particular moments. And honestly, I'm impressed, man. Like I didn't remember that he does his own colors, and to be able to do all this at such a proficient level, I think is insane, man. Mad props. I'm so glad I can go out of this episode on such a positive note. Mad props to Otto Schmidt, man.
Yeah. So how do we feel about the week overall? I think based on the strength of me probably rating Catwoman and Nightwing as 8 out of 10s, and then it kind of went through in my head, I give it like a 6.5, which is, I think the first week I gave everything a 4, and I think the second week I rated it like a 5 or 5.5. So it's a big improvement. We're talking 6, 6.5. Maybe I'll split the difference and call it 6.25. So we're turning in the right direction, but I would be shocked if I ever got above a 7 based on the quality we've seen so far. But yeah, the best week so far. Nightwing and Catwoman are doing the heavy lifting here. Trevor, what about you?
I'd probably give it like a 5.5, something like that. That's still like a 1.5 above the last 2 weeks. I think I gave both weeks a 4.
Yep.
You know, like you said, I mean, Nightwing and Catwoman carried it. I mean, I like Nightwing. I'm clearly not as ready, set, go on it as you guys are, but it was good. It was a good book. Catwoman, obviously, I'm giving, you know, a pretty glowing review, and I'm actually really looking forward to going back and reading what Ram V has done on Catwoman so far. You know, clear downfalls. I obviously despise the Immortal Wonder Woman and the Nubia story, from art to the scripting execution. And, you know, Tim Sheridan's doing what Tim Sheridan's been doing throughout Future State, being a mess. There is this obvious element of disappointment around Philip Kennedy Johnson and his Superman. And the next Batman continues to be middling at absolute best. So, you know, it is a little bit of a bummer that, like, the best we've done so far is like a 5.5 overall in my book, but I will take the gems that we've gotten out of this week and run with them. Which, what's funny that I have to admit is that I didn't actually buy Nightwing or Catwoman this week, which I'm ashamed to say, and I wish it were as simple as trading in some of the books that I did buy from my local comic book shop for Nightwing and Catwoman, because they were the clear winners here.
All right. What about you, Boom? What are your, what's your overall grade?
I'm actually just doing the math. And unfortunately, I actually, looks like I'm at like a 7.85 here overall. What saved it was Nightwing and Catwoman. I love the art in Superman World's War. Shazam was a big stinker that really drove things down. Immortal Wonder Woman, I gave it probably a 6.5 because I really did like the art. Story, I didn't. But overall, this was just, it squeaks out for my favorite week so far, just because of Nightwing and Catwoman alone. Man, I wish I'm just. You know, that they put a smile on my face. And overall, I just want to say just a quick comment, because you've for the second week now, you've mentioned an allusion to Convergence. I feared that this would be like Convergence. I don't feel this is like Convergence. Convergence was, I will say that Convergence, ironically enough, while it was a more cohesive narrative, ironically enough, it was a shitty narrative and it was a terrible story. And it had a bunch of useless side stories that I never got into. I actually find myself more interested in Future State because I guess between the, I don't know, overall, it just has a, I think there's enough that they're doing. I like the initiative. They're doing enough right that they're keeping at least a grin and sometimes a smile on my face. And there's some stinkers here, but I'm going to emphasize again that, you know, with Nightwing, you never know, how Dick Grayson can be so phenomenal in Nightwing and then to have him written so confusing a manner with Teen Titans. I still think that, you know, if they can build off the momentum of Catwoman and Nightwing, because Nightwing really is the Batman here. I'm more interested now in Nightwing in Future State than I am in Jace Fox being Batman, quite frankly.
And yeah. So one more week of, and again, we're going to see some of the titles. We're going to see a second issue like Dark Detective. Most of these only have two, so we're going to get one issue in January and then another issue in February. So, you know, next week we'll obviously cover the final week of January. What I'm really curious to see is the week following that, when we start seeing these second and final issues of these things, can these, you know, crazy wild narratives that the people are telling with, you know, so many different threads in the case of things like Teen Titans or even Shazam, where it's the story's just going everywhere. Can they pull it together? Yeah. My gut tells me no, but you know, I guess we'll see. That's really, I think, gonna be what ultimately is the final judge of quality for this. You know, whether it can be better than a Convergence or not is going to be, how do they bring it home? You know, how do the second issues go? Because that's really going to, whether it should or not, whether it's fair or not, it's really going to set the tone for if people decide to go ahead and pick up Infinite Frontier material or not.
That's such a sad bar. Like, can you beat Convergence?
And I say that, but I know. You know what? This is what they're giving us. And I've been accused of being a DC cheerleader and going easy on them for years, because I love the characters, you know, and I'm willing to kind of look the other way on some of the things that aren't being done well. But you know, I gotta call it like I see it. And unfortunately, most of this stuff is just not good, man. And I go back to a combination of factors. You know, we talked about this stuff likely being rushed, and we talk about kind of the lack of experience working in comics. And again, I think we all know that we need new talent, new voices and that kind of thing, but you bring them in gradually, you know, you don't throw out 90% of your, you know, creative stable of characters and bring in all new creators and think that they're going to do a good job. You bring them in gradually. So the old pros, you know, can kind of show them the way things work. And, and that hasn't happened. What's interesting. So we're talking about the, you know, the two best books of the week here, Andrew Constant and Ram V. Those are the veterans. Those are the guys that have worked at DC for years and do know the lay of the land. You know, we talk about guys like Tim Sheridan. I don't know who this Seven Bergen is that did the Gotham City Sirens or even Philip Kennedy Johnson. You know, they haven't done a lot of work at DC. So,
By the way, Brian Bendis paid tribute to that writer Seven Bergen by naming the future commissioner of Planet Gotham. Is Commissioner Seven Bergen in the Legion of Superheroes.
Then I guess we know how she got the gig, huh?
You know, I'll make the assertion. I was going to say, I'll make the assertion though, that even Andrew Constant and Ram V are relatively new, you know, like, you know, less than maybe 3 or 4 years into the game.
Yeah. But even that amount of experience can be invaluable. You know, when you're talking about these guys are coming in and this is their first DC work.
Well, I think what speaks volume though are that these two are comic book people, and you know, I'm not discouraging people coming from other media because we've gotten good stuff before, but the big thing is that you're bringing people in from other media and you're just assuming not only are they going to know the format, but that they're even going to tell a good story, because frankly,
I think most of the issue,
huh?
Well, they're storytellers. I'm playing the role of Pamela Lyford.
But yeah, geez, sure.
Storytellers.
Yeah, I mean anybody's a storyteller.
But they're storytellers. It's just comics.
It's just comics. You know, it's just
it's easy. Right?
I think just quoting you or paraphrasing you from our inebriated stream. You know, they're just baby books.
That's right. They're just baby books.
they're just little baby books. It's not like, you know, Sandman won a World Fantasy Award or anything, but hey, but like, point being is I like the idea of getting new talent, but why are we not bringing in new hungry talent that are maybe working in the far reaches of the comic book industry?
Good question.
Like, so you're pulling in this Tim Sheridan guy, absolute mess of a storyteller. You're bringing in, Becky Cloonan's a veteran, so her kind of performing as poorly as she has is whatever. The I know the writer of the Nubia story is from prose. You know, you're bringing in all these different people. Man, I could probably name a dozen people working in indie right now with relatively low status that could have given you stories that were 12 times as good as what we've gotten throughout the course of Future State.
I don't see it as much of a problem as bringing in new writers, because I think, as evident by writers like Andrew Constant and Ram V, who are still relatively new, but they're hungry. They're young. They have a passion for these characters, for the worlds, for the stories they're telling. They know the format. Those are the types of people we should have brought in, even if they were of lesser experience and less familiar with DC in particular. The big mistake was bringing in these people from other media that probably felt like they could just phone it in.
Yeah, I think I wouldn't be surprised, and I haven't talked to anybody about this, but I wouldn't be surprised if they did reach out to some of those people. And when they found out what they were paying, they said, no thanks. I'd rather stay over here and continue to write my own stuff for Aftershock or Image or whoever, you know.
It's possible. I would actually be pleased if that were the case, to at least know that these
that wouldn't surprise me at all. You know, they probably said, wait, you're going to pay me what? And the deadline is what? You know, thanks, but no thanks. Like, why would I want the headache?
Yeah, I don't know, man. I mean,
so we'll see. We'll see what happens. But anyway, that's going to do it for this episode. Everybody, thanks for joining us as always. Please be sure you go and follow these gentlemen on their social media. As we're winding up here, we'll give you guys a chance to let everybody know where they can find you online, YouTube, and that sort of thing. You go first, Boom.
I can be found at Comic Boom with an exclamation mark on YouTube, and on Twitter at Metropolis40.
Trevor?
You can find me on YouTube at Dark Knight Nation. Comic book analysis, discussions, things of that nature, deep dive into the technical craft of comics. If you want to see me put my money where my mouth is, I made a comic, Area 51, The Helix Project, sci-fi noir goodness. These two have read it, have refrained from busting my balls about it, so I assume it's at least not as bad as most of Future State, and I'll take it. So if you want a book that's good, might be worth the money, something that is shelf stable, maybe consider picking it up, darkknightnation.com/shop. If you want to see the sort of progress of making a comic book, I tend to try to be very candid on socials. You can find me on Instagram or Twitter at Pocket Watch Press. So yeah, Jace, thanks for having us again, man.
Yep. And that's going to do it, everybody. Thanks for listening as always. And we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.